From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The center recently sponsored a discussion of authorship in the United States in historical and contemporary terms. How do commercial considerations affect publishing in America? How has the rise of conglomerates affected the distribution and marketing of books for popular and specialized reading audiences? The speakers are Lee Smith, Matthew Hodson, Edmund Fuller, and James West. Lee Smith teaches creative writing at North Carolina State University. Her novels include Black Mountain Breakdown, and a collection of her short stories, entitled Cakewalk, has just been published. Matthew Hodson is director of the University of North Carolina Press. Edmund Fuller is chief book critic for the Wall Street Journal. He's the author of many works of fiction, nonfiction, and textbooks. James West is a scholar at the National Humanities Center. He's a professor of English at Virginia Polytechnic Institute. At the center, he's writing a book entitled The Profession of Authorship in America.
I'd like to go back for 1 second to the question of the publisher's responsibility and just to the idea of commercial publishing today, 1982, because I really feel like that, I mean, I feel very strongly that it's descended to such a level, and I don't know, I mean, Jim might be able to tell me whether I feel like it's worse than it's ever been, that the publishers have been bought up by conglomerates and they're publishing nothing but cat books. And, you know, books about cats and books to sit on coffee tables and, you know, crap romances. And it bothers me very much. And I feel like this is not necessarily what the American public wants to read, that this kind of taste is being imposed upon us from the top by marketing executives who have done these sort of cost studies as to what sells. And then, you know, 85 clone books come out after a bestseller. You know, if you have a whale book, then you have, I mean, if you have a shark book, then you have a whale book and a barracuda book, and you have all this kind of stuff, and it just really, really irritates me in the idea that fiction has to have, has to be commercial, and the things that are presupposed in that term commercial. And we all know that still very good books are still being published, very good novels all along, but it's so much harder. And I feel, for instance, that if my first novel, if I had just written it and it were sent to New York today, that would not be accepted. I mean, 60% less fiction is being accepted now than was in the, you know, pre-1965. And this really concerns me greatly, particularly as a teacher, because I have students who are writing very good novels, and I can work with them on the novels. And I know that these are very good novels sometimes. I've just had one or two. And I know they're not going to be accepted for publication because the sheer number of first novels that goes in and is not accepted is enormous. And they're not, you know, they're not blockbusters. They don't have anything that these people consider commercial. And it's very upsetting to me, the situation that the young fiction writer faces today.
Well, I could, I'm sure Edmund can comment to good effect on this and perhaps more knowledgeably than I can. I was fortunate in getting into book publishing, I think, during the last 4 or 5 or perhaps 10 years, when most firms were essentially proprietary ones. They may have issued stock, but the stock was held by relatively few people, and usually a family was in control of a company, or 2 or 3 families who worked well together. And they were interested in making good livings from these undertakings, and they did. They were very conscious of profits and so forth. On the other hand, many of them did have a sense of social responsibility. The names of their families were on the imprints of these books. And they would, I think, more readily take a chance on a good promising first novel than would be the case today. Many of the publishing firms, the larger ones, are now a part of conglomerates. And the leadership of a conglomerate is perhaps 3 holding companies removed from the publishing firm. Nevertheless, they expect, they pay attention to the bottom line. A publishing firm owned by a conglomerate is also expected to make an additional profit which supports the conglomerate overhead costs. All of these pressures are then visited upon the publisher, his editors, so forth. In a sense, they can't take chances, or they're reluctant to. It's their jobs. I have heard Bob Giroux, to whom Edwin referred, saying that there are no geniuses starving in attics anymore. I'm inclined to think that's true, that people of manifest talent are going to get published. But I also agree with you that it's extremely difficult for a first novelist whose book is or manuscript's creditable and shows promise. I think publishers are less willing to take chances on this now than before. Now, we've been talking about publishers. I think you better talk also about the retail end of bookselling. I think probably teachers of creative writing should say it's going to be tough to get published. You're going to have to be, you know, a lot better than perhaps I was at your age. I do want to get in this retail end because I think that the retailing of trade books, novels, popular nonfiction, and the like, to some extent, dictates the activities of publishers.
Before we embark on that, could I get in just one more word on the direct publishing aspect of it? You have mentioned earlier that admirable and correct phrase, the day of the gentleman publisher, and the days of the proprietary houses owned by families such as the Scribner family, who took their responsibilities seriously, whatever they chose to call themselves. And one of the implicit responsibilities that the proprietary houses always recognized, which was not separate, of course, from the profit motive, was the responsibility to develop and bring along the next generation of writers, and to realize that part of that was their investment, that they had to publish writers whose early books were not going to make a profit, but that whose later books might, and who would be the writers of the next generation.
Is that left to chance now, Edmund?
Relatively more so. Now, you have to particularize. Firms such as Farrar, Straus and Giroux and others are still trying to hang in there with some of the older methods, but with the big conglomerate-owned houses, that is disappearing. And here's another important factor on that. It is, in a curious way, the opposite one, and this is one that Matt would know full well. The conglomerate publishers, I think, like the IRS, like the IRS, does not understand the function of the backlist in publishing, that a publishing house rests on its backlist much more than it rests on the profits of any given publishing season.
What does that mean, the
That
backlist?
Means that you publish books which continue to sell for years and that are in your catalog for years. Some of them may sell more slowly than others, but they stay in print. And that backlist, a publisher still earning money from books that they published 20 years ago, 50 years ago, in some instances, where you're dealing with old and standard houses. The backlist is the heart of publishing.
And this has been abandoned or is being abandoned?
Well, the conglomerate owner knows nothing of backlists very much. The conglomerate owner says, well, how much money did we make this season? How much did this bestseller? Now, bestsellers are a help to any publisher, but the bestsellers of a season don't support the publishing house over the long run. So that these two functions of building backlist, which is also tied in with the developing of the next generation of writers, are implicit common sense business responsibilities, whether they are moral or social responsibilities in addition to that or not. And now I agree with Matt also that the question of book retailing is very important, defer to that now.
Well, I think it's got to be addressed. And the latest statistics that I got from friends in New York and other sources is that book distribution, the retail book distribution sales, 54% of it is now controlled by three or four chains, B. Dalton, Walden Books, so and so. Most of them have their shops in shopping malls that pay relatively high rent. And the rationale for that kind of operation is to stock only bestsellers, to turn them over as rapidly as possible. They are not likely to stock backlist titles. They're not likely to stock the standard poets. This has discouraged, I think, a lot of publishers. It's had an effect upon publishing. What shall we do? You know, shall we publish a very good, perhaps, a history of settlement along the Missouri River? Well, let's go back to the old Reinhardt Rivers of America, which is a very fine series of regional history and so forth. These books could not be published today. Bookstores would not stock them. They don't turn over fast enough.
Jim West?
Distribution has always been the great problem of the American publisher, and distribution plagued publishers as far back as the 1700s in this country. You see, we face a much different situation in this country than, for instance, a British or continental European publisher faces, simply because we are so large, and because until relatively recently in the historical past, we've not had any good way to transport books from place to place. Publishers centralized in New York City in the 19th century, and it's possible as a publisher to run a relatively small operation with relatively low overhead and concentrate simply on the northeastern market and make a profit and keep going. Where you get into trouble is when you try to essay the mass market, when you begin to try to address distribution and advertisement on a national level. You multiply your problems of personnel, of distribution, of advertising, of bookkeeping, of collection, of storage of the backlist. All of those things become much, much more complicated and difficult, and you can find yourself selling a great many more books but losing money. And that's one of the ironies of really any kind of business. This applies not only to publishing but to cans of beans. It is perfectly possible to sell a great deal more and to make less money, in fact to lose money because of problems of cash flow, personnel, unionization, things of that sort. But no, publishers like Matthew Carey, back in the early days of the Republic, had great difficulty with distribution of books. The private bookshop finally just gave out, or almost has given out in this country. It's not a viable commercial proposition anymore. And paperbacks are not the answer either, because there have been two situations historically where paperbacks entered the market in American publishing, once in the 1840s, very briefly, and then again for a longer period from about 1870 to 1890, and in both cases it wrecked the price structure of the publishing industry, and publishers for a long time didn't want to have anything to do with paperbacks or with cheap editions. They wanted to maintain price levels, sell to a relatively small, concentrated, and predictable market. So that's another one of the difficulties that faces an author. It's really, in some ways, to a trade publisher's advantage not to hit that big market, or not to try to, at least in business terms, but to concentrate on a much more predictable little area.
I think I'd say yes and no to that. It sort of depends on what you're doing. One of the a surefire book would be any New York publisher will always publish at least once, every 3 years, a book on Vermont, on the supposition that a great many people in New York City want to move to New Vermont.
Sure.
I doubt that Vermonters read these books or buy them in any quantity. Uh-huh. You do have that kind of book. But I think that many publishers want national bestsellers. I think they always have. I recall my early days on the road as a salesman. And in my time, when you joined a publishing firm, even if you were the son of the president of the firm, the owner of the firm, you went on the road. Mm-hmm. This is the way you learn the list. You learn to sell books, and you learn the competitors list. But you would visit a town like Nashville, which is a good book town, and always has been. And there were at least three family bookstores, and all three were third or fourth generation bookstores. And you had three opportunities to sell your list. Now, you needn't bother. You simply get in touch with a buyer at B. Dalton, or a buyer at Ingram's, which is a big book distributor. One or two people make these decisions for not simply the bookstores of Nashville, but the bookstores of the Southeast and beyond.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the second part in a series of discussions on authorship in the United States. The speakers are James West, Matthew Hodgson, Lee Smith, and Edmund Fuller. James West teaches English at Virginia Polytechnic Institute. He's a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where he's writing a book entitled The Profession of Authorship in America. Matthew Hodgson is director of the University of North Carolina Press. Lee Smith is the author of novels and short stories. Her most recent books include Black Mountain Breakdown and Cakewalk. She teaches creative writing at North Carolina State University. Edmund Fuller is chief book critic for the Wall Street Journal. He's the author of many works of fiction, nonfiction, and textbooks.
One of the scary things about book distribution today is that it resembles most closely pop record distribution, yes. Rock groups. It's also very similar to the marketing approaches used for movies. And one of the great ironies that I've discovered this year is that what's happening to the publishing industry is paralleled most closely by what's happening to pro basketball in this country. That might strike you as an utterly ludicrous parallel, but the similarities are quite striking. In pro basketball, we used to have leagues that were dominated by paternalistic family owners, and we used to have direct dealings between players and owners and a great many other things, but the economic structure has changed so that it's now showbiz, and you have agents, and you have mega buck deals with satellite stations and all sorts of tie-ins on books and records and advertisement, so that I certainly don't think that publishing is going to go the way of pro basketball. But the similarities are striking.
George Steinbrenner might argue with you about that. I would like to make one further comment, though. Everything is relative, and we look at what was America's population, say, in 1920, perhaps a little more than half of what it is now. And the books then, the leading bestsellers were the annual effusions of Zane Grey. These were the top best-selling books for 4 out of 5 years, and they sold in really almost comparable quantities compared with modern bestsellers. The best-selling books in this country, with very few exceptions, have been not literary works of the first order. I think these have been exceptions rather than the rule. The typical bestseller, Gene Stratton Porter was a best-selling writer. I think one of Hemingway's books was a bestseller.
For Whom the Bell Tolls.
Yes, I think the only one that I know of is the leading bestseller. It's been proven that the average American doesn't read
above what,
a newspaper as regularly as the average Briton, but look at the British newspapers. With the exception of the London Times and the Manchester Guardian.
I think Matt and probably Jim would know a great deal more of the statistical truth about this, but just consider something along this area. What is roughly the population now is 200 million in the United States? More, 200 million plus or something. If you look at the probable readership of even the most commercial of commercial writers in paperback, people such as Sidney Sheldon, for example, or Jacqueline Suzanne, or whatever, and or Thy Neighbor's Wife, or something of that sort, and some of which recently have been the recipients of these grotesquely distorted paperback auction bidding and things of that sort, Linda Goodman's Sun signs, etc. Nonetheless, if you put the probable readers of those books in sheer numbers against the population, it still shows that there are remarkably few of the American people even reading what we would consider the most commercial claptrap along the line. And that gives one something to think about.
Yeah, another thing is that I've seen the statistics and don't have them here, but if you contrast the number of books you have to sell to get on the bestseller list for fiction with the number of books you have to sell to get on the bestseller list for nonfiction, it's incredible. I mean, so little fiction is bought proportionally that it's just tiny compared to how many you have to sell to get on the bestseller list with nonfiction.
How many books are published in this country every year? Does anybody know about that?
About 5,000.
What everybody says, every commentator on the business of publishing says that the main problem with publishing is that too many books are published, that there are too many titles coming at the bookseller for him to do a decent job of selling them. And this means that the publisher is put in the position of being a gambler. He has to publish, or thinks he does, 60 or 100 or 200 titles so that of those, something like, you pick your percentage, but probably about 10% will make money, and at least one of those titles will make enough money to make back for him what he's lost on the gamble of the other books. You see, in a business sense, publishing a book is a low-risk gamble. The money that you have to put out to publish a trade book is, comparatively speaking, very low compared to what it can return. You know, there are a lot of businesses in which the percentages are quite different. You know what you're going to have to invest on every single item that you manufacture, and you also know that there is a theoretical ceiling to what it can earn. But that's not true in publishing, and it increases the gambling aspect of publishing. Publishers have always been gamblers, and again, this same set of economic circumstances goes all the way back through book trade history, both in England and America and anywhere. It's always a gamble, and first novels always lose money. That's one of the rules of the publishing profession. They almost never make money.
One thing I wanted to mention is just the writer's best friend has traditionally been the editor, and an editor really is enormously important to you, because no matter how long you've been writing, well, maybe you reach some point, which I've been writing almost 20 years now and have not reached, of being able to judge my own writing as effectively as, or revise as effectively as I can help other people revise theirs. I don't know when you get to the point when you can deal sort of objectively with your own, if ever. You need an editor. You really need an editor. And I think it's worth mentioning that these changes that we've been talking about in publishing have drastically affected the role of the editor. And there are very few editors left, and I'm lucky to have one who really cares, who will call you up long distance to discuss a semicolon and whether you really mean for that semicolon to be there, or if in fact it should be a comma. I mean, she is Faith Sale, who's at Putnam's, and she's one of the few editors who will still do that kind of thing. But even in conversation with her and with other editors, they see that their role, their function has changed drastically because of the way publishing has changed. In other words, one of their main things that they have to do now is become an in-house. They can no longer just simply see their responsibility as finding young geniuses or finding good books. Now they have to not only find them and edit them, but they have to become in-house cheerleaders for the books that they edit, because they're going to be hired or fired as to whether or not those books make money, frankly, or at least break even. And so they have to do things now, like Faith follows a book through every stage of production. She goes to all the, she knows all the people who are the book representatives by name, calls them up, calls me up, you know, and tells me to, you know, look up so-and-so who's selling books in North Carolina, all this kind of thing. They have to try to follow it through the people who are doing the promotion, you know, the whole kind of thing. I mean, it's no longer any sort of pure thing. And these are people who are editors with the firms. I know a lot of other people who simply are middlemen, who are like packagers, I think you call it. I have a good friend in New York who does this, where who will just kind of feel out, again, this has nothing to do almost with what we think of as editing, feel out the market or the pulse of the times and decide that a book needs to be written about such and such, hire a writer, have them start the book, sell the package, all this kind of thing. I mean, it's they're editors, they're acquisitions editors now. I mean, they're editors that, kinds of editors that simply didn't exist years ago. And even the traditional editor like mine now has to fulfill so many more roles and has to know so much more about finance and about pushing a book, that kind of thing.
A lot of the young people who I talk to who are interested in publishing envision themselves going immediately to New York and becoming editors and dealing with the manuscripts of young Scott Fitzgerald and Thomas Wolfe.
I don't think they envision their $11,000 a year that they're going to pay him too and try to live in New York on that.
I can tell you about my first day in publishing in New York. And I graduated from the university here and hitchhiked to New York. I graduated on Friday and showed up at Monday in the offices of the old firm of Appleton Century Cross, which no longer exists except as a medical imprint for Prentice Hall. And no one had given me anything to do, and I was standing around there, and someone came out and he said, "Do you work here?" I said, "Yes." He said, "I want you to take these galley proofs over to the St. Moritz Hotel and give them to Mr. Remark." And this was Eric Maria Remark. And he said, "Do you have cab fare?" And I said, "No, I don't." At that time, I really didn't. So he said, "Draw it from the cashier." So I did, and announced myself at the hotel, and they called Mr. Remark's suite, and I was invited to come right up, and there was this courtly, urbane, a Central European gentleman who asked me to come in, asked me if I would have a join him, him in having a cocktail, and did I know Miss Dietrich, Marlena Dietrich? I didn't know. So I had a champagne cocktail with Eric Maria Remark and Marlena Dietrich my first day in book publishing.
So you're the one who started the myth.
No, I said, "This is swell." You know, I called home about it and, you know, the whole thing. And then when I got back to Avalon, I was sent down to the basement for the next 6 weeks helping to alphabetize the backlist. And I assure you, the backlist went back to 1825. And some of the books had not been dusted since then.
You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me for Soundings. This week, the second in a series of discussions about authorship in America. How do commercial considerations such as marketing, promotion, and distribution affect American writing, editing, and publishing of fiction and nonfiction? A novelist, the head of the University of North Carolina Press, a scholar at the National Humanities Center, and the chief book critic for the Wall Street Journal provide the answers. Authorship in America, Part 2. Be sure to listen this week for Soundings.